This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawain. This hour, we talk about the 13 contenders for the Republican nomination for president and their fifth debate, which was held last night in Las Vegas. As has been the case previously, the debate was split into two parts. Nine took the main stage, while the four who are polling the smallest numbers participated in the undercard. And even as Donald Trump maintains his status as the overall frontrunner, there's been a new wrinkle lately. Hardline conservative Texas Senator Ted Cruz has overtaken Trump in Iowa. And there's talk now among some conservatives that he could serve as a viable alternative to Trump as the eventual nominee. Did last night's debate further Cruz's cause? We'll talk about that and much more this hour with Laura Brown, Associate Professor and Program Director of the Political Management Program in the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Welcome back to Radio Times, Laura.
Great. Thanks so much for having me on this morning.
And Michael Warren writes for the Weekly Standard and is 2012 Robert Novak Journalism Fellow. Great to have you with us, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So let's begin at the very beginning, the open to the debate, which I felt was filled with seemingly foreboding music and, you know, pictures of the candidates, seemingly designed to play into fears regarding national security, which was the main focus of the show. Laura, what was your take on CBS's open, or CNN's, I'm sorry, open to the debate?
Well, I think when you look at how the media networks have been promoting all of these debates, they've really seen them as, you know, almost a fight night type of atmosphere. It's a very entertainment, American Idol type of run-up. You know, you see the quick flashes of the candidates, and then you get this sense that they're ready to pit off against one another. So it is trying to drive audience, drive excitement, drive enthusiasm. And I think with the Paris attacks and the attacks in San Bernardino, there is an awareness that national security and terrorism are front and center in Americans' minds. And this is what the debate was going to focus on.
Michael Warren, Facebook played a part in last night's debate. What do you think of that move on the part of CNN?
This is the first time Facebook has been involved in a debate. And look, this is really good business for all the companies, media entities involved. CNN obviously pushing this idea that it's going to be a big fight. If you looked at all the promotional material for this debate, it was sort of all about conflict and creating conflict. Good for Facebook to have obviously a connection there as well. I was struck by, you know, speaking about the lead up to what happened in Vegas last night, of how much it mirrored professional wrestling. There was a moment right before the debate started, about 5 or 10 minutes or so before, when the cameras went out, CNN's cameras, looking at the cars pulling in of Donald Trump's entourage, and he gets out of the car, and the microphone gets in his face and asks him what he thinks about the upcoming debate, and it looked like, you know, what I used to watch on you know, professional wrestling, getting the fighters, you know, sort of excited and agitated. So it was definitely a show, and I think that benefits all the media companies involved. Not so sure it necessarily benefits the voters watching, but that's a different story.
Okay, fair enough. We're going to get to Ted Cruz in just a moment, but I wanted to focus on Jeb Bush first. The Iowa caucuses are just a month and a half away. And so for Bush last night was a critical moment to kickstart his flagging campaign. Curious to hear what you think of how he did. But first, we have a clip of Jeb Bush's reaction to Trump's proposal to kill the families of terrorists as a way to turn ISIS back. Let's listen.
Donald, you know, is great at the one-liners, but he's a chaos candidate, and he'd be a chaos president. He would not be the commander-in-chief we need to keep our country safe.
Mr. Trump. Jeb doesn't really believe I'm unhinged. He said that very simply because he has failed in this campaign. It's been a total disaster. Nobody cares.
So Jeb Bush, pundits believe he needs to come out swinging to invigorate his campaign. Did he do so last night? And does anybody care? Michael?
I think it was the best performance Jeb Bush has given in a debate. That's a somewhat low bar, given his dismal performances in the past. And I thought that chaos candidate line was great, maybe the best non-Trump line of this entire Republican primary. Look, the problem, though, is that Jeb Bush has essentially no support outside the sort of establishment Republicans who have already signed on, and a handful, really, of voters in Iowa, New Hampshire, who say they're supporting him. He's got a real problem in that, even more than Donald Trump, Republicans, I think it's 38%, 40% in some polls, of Republicans say they couldn't see themselves supporting Jeb Bush. He did, I think, help himself in the sense that he maybe stopped what seems to be a sort of spiraling downward trend of his campaign. And to his credit, he did take on Donald Trump in a way that none of the other Republican candidates seem willing to do. You got to give him credit for that. But as far as it may hurt Donald Trump, but as far as Jeb Bush's campaign is concerned, it's probably too little too late.
Laura, how would you grade Jeb Bush's performance last night?
Well, I agree completely with Michael that it probably is too little too late. But I do think that Jeb Bush is going down swinging. And he is going down swinging because he is a good party regular and somebody who really he sees the Republican Party as being an important part of his life. It is part of the family tradition. And it doesn't surprise me at all that he has kind of put himself in the place of, I'm going to take one for the team because Donald Trump cannot be our nominee. And he can't, as he said last night, insult his way to the presidency.
Okay, so Ted Cruz is enjoying a hefty lead in Iowa, according to several polls. But not sure he managed to do much damage to Donald Trump's overall frontrunner status. Lara, am I wrong about that?
Well, I think that Trump, you know, Ted Cruz did very well for exactly who he is and what he is wanting to do, which is to convey that he is a conservative, reasonable, and solid candidate and alternative to Donald Trump. I don't think, you know, anyone really touched Trump in the sense that he didn't perform poorly. He is the front runner, and as a result, he will continue to lead. But I don't think that that means that other people didn't bring themselves up. And Ted Cruz did put in a solid performance. He will remain in the top tier, and he will continue to probably grow his support in places like Iowa and South Carolina.
Let's take a look at Governor Chris Christie's performance, New Jersey Governor Christie, back on the main stage. Christie was asked the question of whether he would communicate directly with Vladimir Putin and whether he would shoot down Russian planes that entered a no-fly zone in Syria. And then Rand Paul jumps into the conversation. So we're going to take a listen to that bite. Do we have that up?
Maybe because I'm from New Jersey, I just have this kind of plain language hang up. But I would make very clear, I would not talk to Vladimir Putin. In fact, I would talk to Vladimir Putin a lot. And I'd say to him, listen, Mr. President, there's no fly zone in Syria. You fly in, it applies to you. And yes, we would shoot down the planes of Russian pilots if, in fact, they were stupid enough to think that this president was the same feckless weakling that the president we have in the Oval Office is right now.
Senator Paul, I want you to respond to what we just heard from Governor Christie. If there was a no-fly zone, you say that potentially could lead to World War III. Why?
Well, I think if you're in favor of World War III, you have your candidate. But we don't need to confront Russia from a point of recklessness that would lead to war. This is something, this type of judgment, you know, it's having that kind of judgment, who you would appoint and how you're going to conduct affairs, that is incredibly important. I mean, I think when we think about the judgment of someone who might want World War III, we might think about someone who might shut down a bridge because they don't like their friends. They don't want to, you know, they want to get a Democrat.
So Bridgegate snuck in there. And I do want to mention, by the way, that was lightly edited for time. But a little oblique reference to Bridgegate, did that do much damage at all, Lara Brown?
Well, I think Christie, again, propelled himself out front, looked like an establishment alternative. I think at the end of the day, what you're going to see is Rubio and Christie kind of fighting for that lane and Kasich and Bush moving to the side. Rand Paul's comments, while they may be reasonable to some of the things that Democrats feel, and they may actually appeal to some independents, his problem is his criticisms don't do anything within the Republican Party. Everyone on that stage, with the exception of Rand Paul, is essentially in favor of a more aggressive foreign policy. And I think this is where you see Rand Paul can gain a lot of applause in a more libertarian place like Nevada, but he will have a tough time in places where the conservative military strongholds are, like South Carolina.
So how much longer can Rand Paul hold on?
Well, I hope that he holds on at least until basically March 1st, which is Super Tuesday, because I do think he brings an important point to this debate. The Republicans really do need to define what conservatism is. And I think Rand Paul also charged Donald Trump with this at one point, where he asked whether Donald Trump believed in the Constitution, given the fact that he is willing to restrict First Amendment speech rights in favor of security.
Michael Warren, did Chris Christie's performance last night, will that performance bring his numbers up outside of New Hampshire? What do you think?
They could. You know, I think Christie's long been a dark horse in a place like Iowa, not to win, of course, but to place pretty well. There's a lot of sort of on-the-ground organization, the things that I've talked to, people in Iowa who are in the know, believe that if he could deliver a performance like he did in Las Vegas, you know, to reassure people about his candidacy, that he could do very well or do well enough in Iowa to put him in a good position for New Hampshire. I think that could happen, but Laura's right as well that it's a somewhat crowded field with Chris Christie, Marco Rubio, and of course Jeb Bush and Kasich sort of holding those other two down a little bit as well in New Hampshire. That's a real problem for Christie and Rubio, and I was a little surprised actually that Christie didn't target Marco Rubio a little more tough. In fact, I think the real problem is that they agree on too much, and so I think he was leaving his fire for Ted Cruz and I guess Rand Paul as well. But really, those two, Rubio and Christie, are kind of stuck in a detente, really, over the New Hampshire sort of establishment Republican. Rubio, I think, delivered a solid performance as he normally does, and so what we end up with maybe is sort of a status quo situation where Christie and Rubio don't really change their positions, they just sort of solidify them.
Michael, we're up against a break, but we're going to be back in just a moment here on Radio Times with more of our dissection of last night's Republican presidential debate. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. This hour, we're focusing on the fifth Republican presidential debate. There is just one more before the Iowa caucuses in February, and we're getting to the make it or break it point for a number of the candidates. Coming up, we'll talk about that and much more with our guests, Laura Brown, director of the Political Management Program in the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, and Michael Warren is a staff writer for the Weekly Standard and 2012 Robert Novak Journalism Fellow. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the telephone number, 888-477-9499, or you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet works as well, at WHYY Radio Times. So up until now, some of the candidates have been handling Trump and his provocative proposals somewhat gingerly, for fear of, I guess, of losing his base should Trump leave the Republican race. Though for those in the undercard who have less to lose, the gloves came off, and talking in particular about Senator Lindsey Graham. We have a clip here of a Graham reacting to Trump's proposal to ban Muslims from entering the U.S. Let's take a listen.
Donald Trump has done the one single thing you cannot do, declare war on Islam itself. ISIL would be dancing in the streets. They just don't believe in dancing. This is a coup for them. And to all of our Muslim friends throughout the world, like the King of Jordan and the President of Egypt, I am sorry he does not represent us. If I am president, we will work together. People in the faith through all over the world destroy this radical ideology. Declaring war on the religion only helps ISIL.
Michael Warren, why has Lindsey Graham not been able to make more headway?
I mean, Lindsey Graham is, I like Lindsey Graham personally. He's a very funny and I think a very serious United States senator. But he doesn't really represent, I think, where the heart of the party is on a whole lot of issues. And in many ways, he sort of plays a role within the party and within the Senate of criticizing the party's base. I mean, the answer to your question is right there. He's not somebody who's willing to sort of change his positions on, which are somewhat more moderate, on things to win a Republican presidential primary. And to be frank, I mean, really, and I argued this at the Weekly Standard, is that there's really no reason for this undercard debate to even be happening. I think it's really outlived its usefulness, and the fact that Lindsey Graham was willing to sort of tear into Donald Trump, which he's been doing on the trail for the last several weeks and months, just goes to show you that he's got nothing to lose because he has no shot of winning the nomination. So at this point, it's kind of whatever Lindsey Graham says may be interesting. Tells you a little bit something about a certain segment of the party, but in the terms of the presidential race, it's kind of moot.
So how would you shape future debates? Would you raise the bar for those who have thus far been able to make the undercard?
I sort of position myself as saying, a smaller field with just one debate, one main stage debate, no undercard. I kind of said, if we take the top four candidates, you've got Trump, Cruz, Rubio, and Carson, who are top four in the polls right now. Then you've got the Rand Paul, Carly Fiorina, who really are more on the undercard side of the polling. So take them out. Then you've got the three governors: John Kasich, Jeb Bush, Chris Christie. After last night, I'd say keep Chris Christie and Jeb Bush. They are at least saying interesting things and are participating in the debate. Leave out John Kasich, so you're left with a six-person debate. I think you'd have a lot more interaction between the candidates, and the voters would learn a little more about how they what their opinions are. One thing I was struck with last night is there was a really interesting back and forth several times between Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio on a lot of interesting points. And then they would be interrupted by one of the other candidates, like John Kasich or Carly Fiorina. And I think that really took away from the momentum and actually took away from what was an interesting discussion.
Gave a little bit more weight to the free-for-all, atmosphere that kind of
That's right.
We were talking about earlier. Let's get to some emails. Paul writes, I wonder if your guests have one piece of data. Has there been a situation in past elections where one candidate has had the lead that exists in this case and does not become the eventual nominee? And I believe, according to a Monmouth University poll on Monday, Trump has a 41% lead at this point. Lara Brown, what do you think?
Yes, there has been an analogous situation. If you look back to the Democratic nomination in 2004, I think one of the things that's important to realize is that in a lot of ways, that nomination field looked something like what we're seeing on the Republican side just now. Democrats believed that President George W. Bush was very vulnerable. Many Democrats got in that race, from former vice presidential nominee Joe Lieberman to General Wes Clark to former governor and senator Bob Graham to John Kerry, who was then a senator, and Senator John Edwards. And, of course, the person who led for most of the race was actually Howard Dean, Vermont Governor Howard Dean. He had raised the most money come the second quarter and for most of the summer, actually all of the summer and all of the fall leading into Iowa, people believed that Howard Dean would be the Democratic nominee, and he got into a fight with Representative Dick Gephardt in Iowa, where they were both expected to win Iowa. And in fact, when the voting came in, Howard Dean placed third and Dick Gephardt placed fourth. John Kerry and John Edwards came in above them. And frankly, it wasn't until after Howard Dean had had his first real loss that then his scream that became famous and was supposedly the reason he came down was talked about.
Well, the Republican hierarchy, nonetheless, is nervous, as here we are in mid-December, month and a half away from the Iowa caucuses. We're still talking about Donald Trump as the front runner because he is the front runner. A few months ago, many thought of him as a flash in the pan, but now there's talk of a brokered convention. What are the odds that that will happen, Lara?
Well, what we're really talking about is in order to win the Republican nomination, somebody has to win the majority of delegates. And that is not necessarily an easy task. For the first basically 6 weeks of the contest, the delegates are awarded proportionally in those states. So Iowa and New Hampshire and Nevada basically award their delegates in a proportional way. So the statewide kind of overall numbers matter. But if you look at the total way in which the Republicans essentially distribute their delegates, what becomes very, very important are congressional districts, because the Republicans essentially say if you win congressional districts, you should win delegates. Well, that has huge implications for states that tend to, at the national level and in the general election, are blue, places like New York and California, where a number of delegates are given out in those very blue districts. Now, whether or not Donald Trump could actually win, if you will, blue state Republicans is part of what is causing some of the uncertainty around if you have a three-way race where Donald Trump wins some of the contests and some of the delegates, Ted Cruz wins other contests, namely the SEC primary is what it's called on March 1st, where many of the states in the South are voting. And then you end up with sort of a Florida race that brings in the more establishment candidates like Rubio, or perhaps if Jeb Bush, if he is still in the race. And you look at a rise for Chris Christie in a place like New Hampshire, you could essentially see enough delegates being split enough ways that even if the field only reduces to three people, by the time June rolls around, nobody would necessarily have a majority. And if you don't have a majority, then the reality is everybody votes on the first ballot at the convention, and essentially there's a deadlock, there's no decision made. And then on the second ballot, most of those delegates are free to choose who they would vote for. So it becomes a very, very different looking convention and nomination process.
Mm. Let's get to Ben Carson. Michael Warren, if you would, weigh in on his performance. And also, you know, he says he'll run as a third party candidate if a brokered convention were to become a reality. So let us know what you think about Ben Carson last night.
I don't think Ben Carson is really much of a threat for a third-party run. He's also sort of on the wane here. You could see that in the debate last night. I mean, he does excite an element of the Republican base, but he's also, I think, shown himself, particularly in a debate that's focused on national security and foreign policy issues, to be sort of out of his league, sort of out of depth with some of the other members of the field. I have really nothing to base this on other than the fact that I don't see any sort of groundswell of a real independent movement completely attached to Ben Carson in the way that, say, Ross Perot's had a sort of independent move, independent of the Republican Party. Most of the people who like, Ben Carson, who support Ben Carson, readers of the Weekly Standard, people that I meet and talk to on the trail, they're good, loyal Republicans. They like Ben Carson. They like what he has to say. But there are also Republicans and conservatives who aren't necessarily willing to bolt the party if Ben Carson continues to go on the wane.
So if he were to leave, then he doesn't take his base with him necessarily, then therefore giving the Democratic candidates an advantage.
I just don't see much of a Ben Carson base that he can really claim to be his own and be a definite movement to actually be effective in being a spoiler.
Let's talk about the lightning rods last night. I saw Trump, but also Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Any surprise there, Lara?
No, not at all. I mean, the one person, or I should say the two people that are completely safe for all Republicans to attack at will at any time is really President Barack Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
And they did.
Both of them. Yes. I mean, both of them are subject to criticism. It is the one thing that unites all Republicans. So it is also a very good strategy.
Email from Mike. Safety in the homeland was a major topic during the debate. We are told that there is roughly one multiple shooting per day in the U.S., but what percentage would be considered Muslim-related, and where should our concern over safety really be focused? Why do the GOP and the media steer us astray? Michael Warren, what's your reaction to that? You want to tackle that one for us?
Well, look, I mean, there's a I guess what the emailer is talking about is sort of gun control. And if he's expecting the Republican candidates to sort of embrace really any element of gun control, then he might not have been paying attention to politics the last 40 years. I mean, there is, I think, a difference in kind between sort of your run-of-the-mill gun violence where criminals are shooting people, or even sort of your lone mass shooters who have, sort of specific political or ideological or even, sort of mentally deranged motives behind, and something like what happened in San Bernardino, which was really inspired by an organized enemy of the United States, was carried out in part by a foreign actor, that being the wife of the person who was the man who was the American citizen, and really done in a more sort of ideological, cohesive way that I think is as I said, different in kind, and something that's that I think the federal government has a role to be responsive to. There is a debate to be had. We have it all the time. Every time that some incident like this happens, about background checks and those sorts of things. But anybody who's expecting Republican candidates to say, "Well, we're going to abandon our longstanding support for the Second Amendment," is, I think, kidding themselves.
How has Governor Christie managed to handle the question of whether gun sales should be banned to those on the terrorist watch list? Lara Brown?
Well, I think what we're really looking at, I mean, I agree with Michael that, the candidates who are Republican and running in the Republican field, they have to sort of reframe the issue around guns to talk more about terrorism, whether it is the Boston bombing or whether it was the San Bernardino attack or even the Fort Hood shooting, which was officially named workplace violence. I think many of the Republicans are looking at guns through that lens. And certainly Chris Christie has walked this line being in a blue state. He's had to, and he has had to appeal to those who want, as the Democrats consider them, to be reasonable gun control issues, and that, no-fly zone people really should not necessarily, the no-fly list should be people that are prevented from having guns. But at the same time, there is this question about who ends up on the no-fly list, and that is a point of contention with many Republicans.
Yes, he's not the only candidate to take that position. Was anybody surprised last night to see RNC Chief Reince Priebus pre-debate making an announcement from the stage? Michael? I ask that because we've got a tweet from PJ who says, pre-debate announced from stage and on air that GOP's goal is achieving competence. Is that crazy? What do you think about that?
look, in an odd way, Reince Priebus and the RNC has played an outsized role in this whole debate process. You have to sort of examine what's happened to the national committees, not just the Republicans, the Democrats, too. They've lost a lot of power and influence over the last several decades because the way that our presidential campaigns and the way our politics are run is different. You know, candidates, super PACs, individual outside independent expenditure groups play a bigger role in the sort of fundraising big apparatus that used to be these national committees is no longer. That being said, they do have, and the Republican National Committee in particular, has a small amount of power over the way that these debates are run. And so they are, and that's because they do control what happens in the national convention. And Laura was talking about that earlier, about how that could actually be somewhat of a brokered convention and could really be kind of chaotic. And so they've been able to use this sort of a carrot and the stick and say, look, if you don't participate in the debates that we've sanctioned, we can take away your delegates. And so they have actually been able to exude a lot of control over this process at a time when otherwise they really have no control. So over much of anything else. So I think to see Reince Priebus up there talking, I think, with rose-colored glasses about the way the process has worked out. And in reality, I think everybody in the Republican establishment is sort of scratching their heads at the Donald Trump phenomenon, at the potential of a brokered convention, and is going, I thought we had this under control. I think the more they've tried to control the situation, the less they've been able to exude that control.
Thanks, Michael. We're up against a break. We are talking about last night's Republican presidential debate. Did you watch it? If so, what did you think? And if you didn't watch it, why didn't you watch it? Let us know. 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you or send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. And this hour, we are taking a look at the fifth Republican presidential debate. And again, there's just one more before the Iowa caucuses in February, and that is in mid-January. Our guests this hour, Michael Warren, staff writer for the Weekly Standard. He also contributes to the Wall Street Journal, and he is 2012 Robert Novak Journalism Fellow. And we're also joined by Lara Brown, director of the Political Management Program in the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. And if you'd like to join the conversation, as always, you are welcome to do so. 888-477-9499 is the telephone number. You can send us an email as well, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Kevin Madden, former advisor to Mitt Romney in 2012, is quoted as saying that if Trump were the nominee, it would be a general election disaster, in his words, for us up and down the ticket. So how would a potential Trump nomination actually affect those in the GOP who are running for Congress or running for re-election? And Lara Brown, Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey comes to mind.
Well, I do think that what you actually see going on is that many of the voices in the Republican Party, rather than talking about the fact that Trump will not be their nominee, are now talking about what a disaster he would be if he were, because that is a way to appeal to his voters to say, don't make this mistake. You're going down the wrong road. I actually don't believe that at the end of the day, the Republican Party would ever actually allow Donald Trump to be the nominee. So I do think what you would see is you would see a massive coordinated effort around whichever establishment is left. And I do think that the party would even be willing to accept Ted Cruz, who prior to Donald Trump was sort of the unacceptable black sheep of this crew. And I think what you'd really see is a much more contested convention.
Does all the focus on Donald Trump mean Hillary Clinton essentially gets a lot less attention and scrutiny from the press, Michael Warren?
Yes, and I think that's wrong. I mean, in, a colleague of mine pointed out that Donald Trump has a bigger lead in some polls over his Republican rivals than Hillary Clinton does over Bernie Sanders. There is a sort of lack of coverage of Hillary Clinton and the Democratic primary, the fact that she does have this somewhat rump opposition from Bernie Sanders. It's not something that's I think is ultimately going to keep her from the nomination, but it does show that there is some discontent within the Democratic primary, and yet all the attention is focused on Donald Trump and the sort of possible disaster that he could pose for Republicans. Look, I think that's worth covering as well, but the Democrats have some of their own issues too, and those are worth discussing. One thing I do want to say about this question of Donald Trump's effect on the Republican candidates and the Republican Party, I think thinking that Donald Trump's supporters really care one whit about the Republican Party's fortunes. I think if you believe that, I think you misunderstand the appeal of Donald Trump and why he's doing as well as he is. There's also this question about what kind of electorate does a Donald Trump nomination bring to the presidential election. I think it's something that we don't really know or understand. He's getting a lot of support, not necessarily from the far right, although there's some of that, but also from the kind of radical middle of the country, blue collar, mostly white, and people who don't necessarily have a college education but feel maybe disaffected from the political system. That's an electorate that I don't think we're quite we've quite got our arms around in terms of understanding, and I think that's something good to keep in mind.
So should he be the eventual Republican nominee, you're saying that in November he could attract votes from across party lines?
He could. That doesn't necessarily mean he would win. I mean, in a lot of ways, some of your standard Republican voters, people who have come out, white-collar Republican voters who've come out the last several elections, might defect to Hillary Clinton. They might just decide to stay home. What I'm saying is that we're thinking this in terms of what would it look like if Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were facing off with an electorate that looked like 2012, 2008, 2004, 2000, in terms of the breakdowns. And I kind of question whether that would even happen, and if this sort of standard party lines as we understand it would be completely blown up. And I think that's where there's a lot of confusion and where people aren't quite understanding what's going on, and because we have no test case.
Okay. Calls are coming in to 888-477-9499. Let's get to Steve in Mount Airy. Steve, you're live on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
My question is, do the Republican voters care about climate change? And if so, why isn't this issue addressed by Republican candidates, particularly in the light of the recent Paris summit on climate change?
Laura Brown, you want to tackle that one?
Well, I mean, the really simple answer is it is not high on the Republicans' list of priorities of issues that they care about. So Pew Research has done some great polling and surveying, looking at what are the issues that are top of mind to those partisans. And for Democrats, in fact, they really do see that climate change is, nearly as important as something like terrorism, but the Republicans do not see that at all as being a threat to our future life.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Steve. And let's get to an email from Bob. Bob says, Carly Fiorina, no mention of her performance. And I know, Michael, that you referenced Carly briefly earlier in the show. But let's talk about her performance in full. She seemed to be strong and clear and concise, agree with her or not for her views. So where does Carly stand as far as moving forward? Michael, what do you think?
The problem for Carly Yeah, I think the problem for Carly Fiorina is that she doesn't have much more of a message beyond the fact that it would be great to see her debate Hillary Clinton. I think a lot of Republicans love the idea because they feel, I think with a lot of justification, that that Hillary Clinton is sort of using her gender and her the possibility of her being the first woman president in an unfair way. And so the idea possibly that you could have the Republicans could nominate a woman as well is somewhat appealing. But you've got to have more of a message than that. And I don't know if Carly Fiorina has really broken out of that. She talks a little bit about good government and competence and sort of bringing private sector, the way of private sector companies think into the way the government works. But beyond that, I think she's just sort of a lot of noise and hasn't really risen or pushed her message to something that moves beyond just those things that that sort of catapulted her to the main stage. She had an okay performance. There was one moment where she tried to interrupt, a Cruz Rubio debate, and I think it ended up hurting her. She sounded like she was being a little rude, and so I would expect that Carly Fiorina doesn't really improve where she is in the polls.
And Lara Brown, what's your take?
Well, I mean, I agree with Michael that Carly Fiorina has kind of one big problem that the other two outsider candidates, Donald Trump and Ben Carson, don't have. And that is that she's not a celebrity. Quite frankly, Donald Trump is more than a businessman. And Ben Carson, who actually had Cuba Gooding Jr. play him in a movie, also have essentially a patina of celebrity that she doesn't hold. And in fact, her loss in the senatorial race in 2010 against Barbara Boxer really also weighs on her reputation of being somebody who could be an effective outsider.
Let's get to the phones. Fayek from North Philly, you are live on Radio Times. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking from my call.
Sure.
I just want to comment on a couple of things. First thing, it's not only like white people are supporting Donald Trump. They're like a lot of immigrants like me who are supporting that guy. And even though everybody is against him, like media, Republicans, Democrats, he's still leading in a poll because people are with him. And not only like they're saying people are like who have a high school education, they're with him. I'm sure like they're like a lot of professors, doctors, lecturers, lawyers. So, they're also supporting. He's talking on the issues. So at least give that guy credit.
So the reason you are supporting him is because you say he is talking about the issues?
Yes. He hit a nerve, actually, what's going on in this country. Nobody wanted to talk before him what's going on about an immigrant. I'm also an immigrant by myself, but what he's saying about immigration, that's true. And what he's telling about terrorism and what's going on all around the world, he's telling a reality.
So where do you? I'm sorry to interrupt you, Fayek. We're a little bit short on time. So you say you're an immigrant. Where have you come from?
I came from Pakistan.
And so the fact that Donald Trump is saying, you know, we need to ban Muslims from coming into the country at least temporarily until everything gets sorted out. How does that sit with you as an immigrant?
Well, the way it's because I'm a Christian immigrant from Pakistan. My family ran from persecution of Christians in Pakistan because of majority of a Muslim. I'm not saying all Muslims are bad, but it's the same thing. It's true, like all Muslims are not terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslims, right? And they're waging a jihad in the name of their religion. If somebody says like it's wrong, they are telling a lie. When their religion says, their holy book says, that Christians and Jews, your enemies, and all that stuff, I don't want to go into details right
now. Sure, sure.
That's true. Right. But at least all I'm trying to say, like, give that guy credit. He's one guy who take on everybody, and everybody's confused what he did.
Fair enough.
He's absolutely right.
Thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. Let's get to breakout moments last night. Did anybody really have a breakout moment? Any of the candidates? Lara Brown, in your opinion?
No, I don't think so. But I do think a number of candidates kind of helped their cause, and Donald Trump did not hurt his. So I think what you're going to see is a little bit more shuffling of the deck in the polls, but it's going to be kind of marginal changes in the numbers.
Lara, who did the most to help their cause?
Well, I think Marco Rubio showed time and again that he really could take on tough questions and could defend his sort of Gang of Eight immigration proposal, which was a great vulnerability within this Republican field.
Michael Warren, any breakout moments in your mind?
No, I think it was somewhat of a status quo debate. I do think there was an interesting moment. I admit to not being able to really wrap my head around who the winner in that sort of ongoing Cruz and Rubio battle was. It really kind of depends on your perspective as a Republican voter. I mean, Rubio, as Laura said, I think did the best he could with the weakness of the Gang of Eight bill. And you know, Ted Cruz came off maybe even a little too harsh, you know, frequently insinuating that Rubio was lying about Cruz's record. At the same time, Cruz has a lot of goodwill with conservative primary voters, and he's on top. And so, in a way, by kind of punching down onto Rubio, he may very well stop any kind of Rubio insurgency. So it's hard to say, but those two, I think, are the ones to watch. Donald Trump, I think, is staying exactly where he is.
And that brings us to an email from Carol, because Ted Cruz, he went after Rubio, but he really still treated Donald Trump, I felt, with, I don't want to say kid gloves, but he didn't really go after him too hard. And she says, I think the reason Ted Cruz isn't criticizing Donald Trump much is because he knows he'll inherit Trump's voters. Sometimes, Carol says, I think Trump knows he'll never win, but is having fun, and also knows and is glad his voters will go to Cruz eventually, since he and Cruz think alike. Scary. What is your reaction to that comment, Lara Brown?
Well, I do think that Donald Trump got in this race initially to bring Jeb Bush down. And I do think that he has made somewhat of a peace with Ted Cruz. One of the most interesting tweets I saw last night is, do you think we are seeing the beginnings of a Trump-Cruz ticket? And the big question I have with that idea is that then one of them has to drop out in order to be named later as the vice president. And I'm not so sure that either one of them has the ego and the humility to allow themselves to drop out with the idea that they would later be picked. And so this is where, at some point, Cruz and Trump are going to have to get into a fight, because, you know, your writer is right that they are competing for some of the same voters, although many more of Ted Cruz's voters are really coming to him from Ben Carson's fall.
But Michael Warren, when does that happen? After Iowa?
I don't know. I mean, I really think that the schedule and the calendar of the primary sort of gives Cruz really no reason to go after Trump. I mean, in a way, it's a very kind of clever move to never really draw Trump's ire. There was this New York Times article that revealed that Cruz had actually been somewhat critical of Trump behind closed doors, and they sort of, in this debate, kind of ended up making nice. I think it's to Cruz's benefit in the short term. The long term, it's hard to say when he really drops the hammer. I think everybody's kind of walking around on eggshells, except for Jeb Bush, on Donald Trump, because they don't really know when and if this whole phenomenon is going to sputter out. I think nobody knows, and that's why you're seeing Ted Cruz among them sort of play nice, and I think the other candidates did as well.
One quick question. We've only got about 30 seconds left. Lara Brown, any glaring falsehoods last night from the candidates?
Well, I think one of the things that you see is that there are a lot of falsehoods. I mean, one of the things Carly Fiorina talked about was that our government could not check, you know, the social media accounts of those who were the terrorists in San Bernardino. That's actually not true. They have the ability to do it. It was not done. But that is a different story. And so I think we do see falsehoods like that or shadings of the issue all throughout the debate.
Lara Brown, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. Lara is director of the Political Management Program in the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. And Michael Warren, great to have you with us as well. Michael is staff writer for the Weekly Standard and 2012 Robert Novak Journalism Fellow. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. Hour two is just ahead. Stay with us.